Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 24, Norse Mythology, Part 2. As I mentioned just now, we have the fascinating Norse people, particularly the Vikings, with all of the legends and sort of more modern myths that have arisen about them. And it's kind of a temptation to put a map of Norway on the board and show the fjords and the ports, the natural ports from which the Vikings could leave, show the Viking ships and their sails and all of those things. And this is very nice, and I would encourage you to do it, but really be careful that this does not take over and that you don't find yourself spending a whole week on the nature of the Vikings. It's the myths that are the most important things for the children. In the same way, you'll see in grade 5, you're not going to teach the children about the character of the ancient Indian people and who was king and who conquered what. It's 100% mythological in ancient India. Same with Persia. Though Zarathustra, we could say, is a historical figure on one level, but primarily we're still teaching the children history on the soul level. Same with Egypt. The major stories have to do with the gods and goddesses. And there again, one wants to be careful not to go too much into the minutiae of everyday life. It's only in Greece that we start to come to documented history. And even then, a good deal of what we teach the children about Greece, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the pre-Socratic philosophers, it's half legend, half myth, and a little bit of historical documentation. So you can see the curriculum tells us it's not until fairly late in fifth grade, and then certainly in grade 6, that children are ready for and needing the figures, the data of real authenticated history. So don't overdo that. Another aspect of working with the people and the place too strongly is something that has, in a certain way, assumed far too great a place in the fourth grade curriculum. And I think it's at the expense of teaching what the children really need to be learning. And this is identifying then anything that took place in the north with the Norse myths. Since it's all up there in the north, it must all be the same. One of these documents, which is often worked on by a class for many weeks preceding the Christmas assembly, is the Dream Song of Olaf Asteson. A very beautiful work, a very powerful work, one which is basically adult in content. And even though it can be sung beautifully and it has been put to music and maybe you have someone who can teach it to the class, there in some schools have a tradition. The fourth grade will always do this. I would say it has nothing to do with Norse mythology. It's a completely Christian document and very little to do with the fourth graders' life experiences, which have to do with coming into life, which do not have to do with crossing the threshold of death. That's something they're going to encounter in grade 5 very powerfully, especially among the Egyptians and later, to some extent, the Greeks as well. So it's jumping ahead. And once again, how this came into the Waldorf curriculum for grade 4 is anybody's guess. Steiner has spoken about this book, but he's spoken about a lot of things. He's spoken about Faust a lot, too. Nobody would think of teaching that because it's kind of written by someone from the north, so the fourth grader should hear it. So there again, if it's a tradition in your school, if there's somebody like the music teacher who always works on it with the children, you're kind of stuck. But it might be something good to discuss with your colleagues. once you can present to them the developmental nature of the fourth grader. Does this really belong? Secondly, is something that you're very, very likely already planning to teach. Maybe you already have the book because your predecessor teaching fourth grade gave it to you and said, this is the greatest thing and you have to do it. And this is the Kalevala. And one reason that the Kalevala has become something of the canon of fourth grade Waldorf education is because there have been some very influential teachers who have brought this. And I would say the most influential of all has been Astrid Schmidt-Stegman, for many years a stalwart pillar of Rudolf Steiner College, who has brought this poem again and again in summer conferences and also to her teacher trainees, retelling parts of it herself. And when she tells this story, I can tell you there's not a dry eye in the house. It's very beautiful. And of course you're going to want to share this with your children, but Astrid could tell Anna Karenina and there wouldn't be a dry eye in the house either, or the catcher in the rye or anything. It has to do with Astrid's very strong connection to this work, but it has nothing to do with the appropriateness of this in and of itself incredible epic to fourth grade children. And this is, I think, we always have to come down to this. There are many great things that I would have loved to have shared with my classes in grades 1 to 8 and never could because they were high school, even college material. Just because it's great and just because I as a teacher like it doesn't automatically mean that it's right. What's the problem with the Kalevala? Doesn't it come from the north? Yeah, it does. But what part of the north? From Finland? From the Finnish people? Yeah, well, they're kind of the north, right? You know, the Finns are a completely different race altogether. They're not Scandinavian. They're not Swedish or Danish or Norwegian or even Icelandic. They're much closer to the Slavic people, but even there, the Laplanders, for example, have an entirely different origin. And what Steiner had to say about the Kalevala, and like the dream song of Olaf Asteson, he said it was a great book. He said it was important for anthroposophists to read, become familiar with, live into. But he said very clearly that the Kalevala was the last of the great epics to be written down. Even longer than the Norse myths, the Kalevala remained strictly an oral tradition until the late 19th, early 20th century, when a physician moved around Finland and heard the bards who would sit on a seesaw, teeter-totter, and go up and down with a kind of call and recitation method of relating this. And he then wrote it down, and he compiled it, and he made it more literary, and so on and so forth. Steiner has said very clearly that the Kalevala will be for our time, for the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, what the Iliad and the Odyssey were for the ancient Greeks. That in the same way that adults in ancient Greece lived with those myths and were, tremendously transformed by those stories and the way in which Homer, the poet, related it, so will we, and not even yet, but in the future, increasingly, find that the Kalevala is the epic of our age, of our epoch, the epic of our epoch. It is not children's material. One day it will be, but right now it's dealing with themes, it's It gives one a spiritual experience in the hearing of it or the reading of it that is appropriate for the constitution of the adult body, the physical body and the higher members, not that of the child. So it's something that's misplaced. And it's not to say children don't enjoy it, love it, especially if the teacher does. But once again, it means you have less time to do something else. If you have a whole block on the Kalevala, and teachers have done that, either you're not doing sufficient amount of time with the Norse myths, or maybe you're doing less zoology or less geography. You just can't do it all. So here again, however, the powerful influence that Steiner College has had in particular in making the Kalevala so popular has led to all kinds of anthroposophical translations, retranslations, children's versions, guides to children's versions, and so on. And here again, in your school, it may be a tradition, it may be a given. Your mentor may just say, you do it. Where, if that's the case, you can't change that, but perhaps here's another area in which you can have a good conversation with your colleagues about whether the Kalevala is really the right content for your class. So my two caveats are, watch out, don't get too historical and anthropological and feel that you have to present the Vikings to the children. And secondly, don't necessarily be drawn into the byways of books like Olaf Asteson and the Kalevala, which, though they come from the same general geographical location, are born out of different stages of consciousness. So certainly the origins, the physical origins of a work of art are very important, and that's sort of the historical anthropological side. But we are working with the consciousness origins. When did that come into being? What was its purpose? Who brought it? Which spiritual beings stand behind it? And on what, which of the bodies does that work? And I would say that in the light of that filter, if we give it that test, then neither Olaf Asteson nor the Kalevala are appropriate for the children. One more. And this one isn't not really an issue in most schools, but there are two versions of the Norse myths. One of them is the one that is done by tradition, and I think appropriately in the Waldorf school, and that, as I said, is the Icelandic version. So the names, the terms, all of this comes via the Icelandic people and has been to a certain extent gently but noticeably Christianized by the great Icelandic monk who codified them and brought them into print. There's another tradition, and this is the Germanic tradition, because the German people shared many of the same gods and the same mythology with the Viking people. And the big difference is, besides names, a lot of the names change to some extent, although they're all pretty recognizable. But the important difference is that in the Icelandic stories, human beings count for very little. You know, human beings are just part of Midgard. They're kind of just there. Among many other creatures in the middle. And the relationship of human beings and the gods is a very tentative one, though there are later stories which will bring in more of a connection there. But basically, we are learning in the Icelandic stories what could be called a theogony, which means that it's stories of the gods. The German versions, however, which came into codification later, which really belong very much to the minstrels of the Middle Ages rather than the bards of a slightly earlier time of the Dark Ages, these stories bring a much stronger connection between the gods and the human beings. And in fact, the central figure, the one who's going to redeem the failings of the gods, is a human being, and this is Siegfried. So these are often called the Siegfried stories, or they're also seen in the general overview as the Nibelungenlied, the Song of the Nibelung. And this has to do particularly with a golden ring, a golden hoard turned into a golden ring, which conveys the power of invisibility. But beyond that, or we might say invisibility is the symbolic picture, that it conveys power, absolute power over others. If they can't see you and don't know that you are there, you can be doing anything. And it is from this great epic that Richard Wagner drew inspiration for his yet even more modernized 19th century operatic quartet, which is the story of the ring. And here we have then one of the greatest works of art ever created by a human being, which bases itself very strongly on this mythology. But it's not the Norse myths, it's now the Germanic myths. I'll continue with this in the next lecture and move us now in the direction that we really want to go.